need to talk. It's okay. Just another minute here. A lot of logistics.
Yeah.
But all right. I think it'll be all right here. All right. Good evening, everyone. I'm sorry that we're a little bit delayed this evening. So first of all, our shiur tonight is dedicated in the merit of a refuah shlema from El Pacino, from Moshe ben Sion, ben Leah Rachel, and we hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, he will continue to have a refuah.
Amen.
All right, so we find ourselves in our, it's hard to believe it, this is our last class in the series. It wasn't much of a series, but okay. And once again, I find myself feeling the need to deviate just a little bit from what it is that we had originally spoken about, or what we were originally going to cover. Because the truth is, and I owe an incredible debt of gratitude to all of you, in the course of preparing the shiur, I realized that there's almost as much to be learned from the Rav by studying who he was as we can learn from his actual Torah. So once again, I'd like to be able to spend this evening shiur focusing a little bit just on understanding the personality of the Rav, this time a little bit more through his actual teachings. In last shiur, we spoke about the great contrast of the Rav. We showed how the great dialectic that made Rav Soloveitchik, this idea of how one man could be comprised of such opposing and almost polar opposite poles was very much a result of the upbringing he had. He really had an incredible, just like a chalent of just Judaic influences. Everything you could possibly imagine, from growing up in Lithuanian aristocracy, ultimately to the Chabad Malamed, who was an incredibly pivotal influence on him. So I want to show you something amazing. Take a look at number one. This is actually from a brand new book that just came out. It's called recently, it's called Majesty and Humility. And it's an excellent book. Essentially, what the authors have done, it was edited actually by Rabbi Dr. Schachter. And what this book really seeks to do is to give an overarching understanding of the Rav's philosophy. So the book itself is broken down into multiple parts, and each part is different. So there's a part about the Rav and relationships, there's a part about the Rav and the state of Israel, there's a part about the Rav of fate and destiny. So in here, this is in the introduction, he has something that I never heard before. Let's take a look at this. Paragraph A. The year 1967 was extraordinarily trying for the Rav. Let's make sure this is on. And a welcome to everyone who's joining us online. I'm sorry that we got started late today. So the year 1967 was extraordinarily trying for the Rav. Within months, his wife, mother, and brother all passed away. Sorry, give me 1 second here. Not sure what's going on here. Hopefully it's working. The year 1967 was extraordinarily trying for the Rav. Within months, his wife, mother, and brother all passed away. Although he did manage to return to a productive career of teaching after this period of crisis, and in fact, it is in fact said that the study and teaching of Torah had helped him overcome it, echoes of it reverberate throughout his later writing. Paragraph B. Many attribute to this period, early to mid-1960s, a significant change in the Rav's temperament. In an address at Yeshiva University at the conclusion of the Rosh Shloshim, 30-day mourning period, his son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, related his different experiences in the Rav's Talmud Shir. In the 1940s and 50s, the Rav had been a volcano, a storming lion in the classroom. He could crouch like a tiger and leap at the slightest error that a student would make. This is actually very interesting. Rav Soloveitchik was known for this, that if you would say something that did not make sense, he would hand you your head on a platter. The Rav was not like this beautifully caring, warm, you know, there are some teachers who anything a student, oh, that's an excellent question. That's wonderful, so profound. Did you think of that on your own? The Rav was not a coddling teacher. The Rav, if you did not say something, that's why, interestingly enough, again, they were always able to tell who were the newcomers to the Rav Shir, because the newcomers to the Rav Shir would often pipe in with their comments. And they say that the more experienced guys would just shake their head, just waiting for the Rav to come down on the new students. We'll see why the Rav did this. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik writes that his father in the early days was this crouching lion, this erupting volcano, could leap at the slightest error that a student would make. However, when he entered his father's shir in 1969, this is the son, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, when he entered his father's shir in 1969, he was shocked to find him gentle, forbearing, very little upset him. Why the change? So what you're about to hear right now is not something you're going to find in the Rav's writings. What we're about to hear right now is a son's analysis as to the development, evolution, and change in his father's personality. Look at paragraph C. According to Professor Soloveitchik, the Rav's father had trained him with the assumption that everything was superable through effort. Indeed, contrary to most people's impression of a meteoric career, the first 40 years of the Rav's life had been an endless overcoming of obstacles, war, poverty, anti-Semitism, politics. Thus, both Rav Moshe and the Rav believed that, generally, intellectual error was tantamount to a moral failure, a failure of will and effort. Rav Soloveitchik responded to error with fury because he believed it to be a mark of laziness and self-indulgence. If his students would try harder, if they would care more, then they would reach a better grasp of the material they were studying. So it wasn't the pshat that the Rav wasn't loving. The Rav was exceptionally loving. The Rav was very fatherly and paternal to his students. But the Rav felt that when you were in the shir demanded intellectual excellence. And if you did not demonstrate intellectual excellence, there's only one reason for that, and that is because you're lazy, because you're not trying hard enough. If you did not get the right answer, you said something that was not well thought out, that is laziness. And in the Soloveitchik world, there was no room for laziness. Now, just so you should understand, the Rav's approach to this was very stark, was very harsh and very strict and exact. I will tell you, though, this concept, they say about Rav Pam Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. So Rav Pam said, my father actually told me that he heard this from Rav Pam, that Rav Pam said that the worst word in the English language, so you can imagine, if I were to ask you, what is the worst, most terrible word? Don't volunteer answers here, right? But what's the worst word a person could, so we have all kinds of ideas. Rav Pam said the worst word that a person could ever use is whatchamacallit.
Oh.
He says, why? Because if you're saying whatchamacallit, it means that you haven't properly thought through what you're about to say. And Rav Pam said, how can you open your mouth without knowing what it is that you need to say and how you're supposed to say it? So the Rav wasn't alone in this approach. It's just the Rav reacted in a very, to borrow Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's terms, in a very volcanic approach. So if you went ahead and you said something that was half-baked, that was not fully thought out, that was not correct, the Rav felt that means you're lazy. That means ultimately you are not living up to your intellectual responsibility as a perpetuator of the Mesorah. And there is no room for laziness in Judaism. He goes ahead in parentheses, he writes, of course, he held himself to that same high standard, devoting long hours of intense preparation for his classes. Watch this. However, in the 1960s, Rav Soloveitchik had to cope with his own ultimately successful bout with cancer and his wife's ultimately unsuccessful struggle with the disease. Remember again how we started out. In 1967, the Rav loses his wife, his mother, and his brother all in the same year, all within a couple of months. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is coming into his father's shir in 1969. Nice. So what happened? In 1967, the Rav has an incredible discovery. What's the discovery? At this point, he discovered a sense of helplessness. Mm-hmm. Not everything could be accomplished by sheer force of will. This caused the shift in his attitude to his students. He came to terms with human limitations and vulnerability. So I think that this is so incredibly exceptional. You see, all of us go through this maturation, but the truth is, for most of us, it happens earlier on in life. Meaning, what's the greatest mark of youth? Right? You think you could do anything. You think, and by the way, it's good. It's important to think that way. But when we're young, we think we could do anything. We could accomplish anything, and we could change anything. It's as we get older, we realize we can do a lot. We can accomplish a lot. But there are certain things that we can't change. There are certain realities with which we must exist. And the truth is, when we have those moments, which you all experience, those are some of the most somber moments of adulthood. When we realize that, like the Rav realized, you can't accomplish everything through sheer will. There are some things that they are just the way they are. So Chaim Soloveitchik writes, this caused a shift in his attitude to his students. So now what happens in 1969 or post-1967? The Rav becomes more accepting of what? Of the limitations of his students. When the Rav is forced to accept his own limitations and the fact that, again, no matter how much sheer will he had, he could not save his wife. And the loss of his wife was exceptionally traumatic for the Rav, which we'll discuss. No matter how much he tried, no matter how much he cared for her, no matter how much he loved her, he could not save her. Once he realized that you can't accomplish everything through sheer force, suddenly it changes the way he interacts with others, including his students. Suddenly he becomes a little bit more accepting of human limitations, of what the Rav himself calls the finitude, the limits of man. Paragraph D, this change in temperament may also reflect a shift in emphasis in the Rav's writings. In the writings of the 1960s and 70s, the themes of surrender, humility, the heroism of defeat, and childlike dependence on God assume highlighted prominence. Although these themes may be present in his earlier writings, they are certainly not as central. So it's not just the shift in how the Rav went ahead and acted towards students, it's a fundamental shift in the Rav's personalities. Again, he begins to write about these things, surrender, humility, heroism, and defeat, childlike dependence, things that the Rav in pre-1967 would not have written about. Why? Why? Because he didn't believe in it. Because he didn't believe in surrender. Because he didn't live in it. If you're defeated, then what does that mean? What does it mean if you're defeated? It means you didn't try hard enough. It means you were lazy. So don't be so lazy, you won't be defeated. It's only post-1967 that the Rav realizes it's not true. There are times in life where you could be defeated even if you try very hard. There are times in life where you could be defeated because there are simply circumstances that are profoundly beyond your control. So we see over here that the loss of the Rav's wife, of his brother, of his mother, but really most acutely his wife, has not just an impact on him now as a widower, but ultimately has an impact on his thinking, on the way he approaches his students, on what he chooses to focus on in his writings. And I want to show you something very interesting. So this leads the Rav to another reality. Turn to page two. So over here, I copied for you a section from Ala Tshuva. So Ala Tshuva is a compilation. Remember, as I mentioned last week, the Rav himself wrote a lot, but the Rav himself didn't publish much in his lifetime. Why didn't the Rav publish in his lifetime all that much? Because the Rav was a, for lack of a better term, for lack of a better term, what I'll say is the Rav was a fluid thinker. What does it mean to be a fluid thinker? It means that the realities, the intellectual realities you accept as being unequivocally true now, don't necessarily remain that way as you intellectually mature. Meaning, if you think about it, one of the greatest difficulties we have in life is what? Is we become firmly rooted in things that we hold to be true. Now, on one hand, that's good, because at the end of the day, that's why certain aspects of our belief are unshakable. That's why tenets of our emunah cannot be shaken, even when tumultuous or difficult events happen. But on the other hand, it has a downside. What's the downside? Nobody knows, Baruch Hashem. You become too rooted in your ways and not open to the possibility of change or new ideas. The Rav was in constant state of intellectual evolution. The Rav was always thinking, rethinking, evaluating, and reevaluating things. What's the problem with writing?
You put it instead.
When you write something, right? This is the power of the written word. The power of the written word is you put it on paper, and it's there, li'olam va'ed. It's there. It's permanent. Now, okay, so you could go back and you could change and you could edit it. But the truth is, it's there. It's created. So it appears that the Rav was hesitant, therefore, to often commit things to writing, because again, for the fluid, constantly intellectual evolution, to put something down in writing means that I'm limited to this. I'm limited to this. That's why when we speak about the Rav's writings, you'll notice that I would venture to say a good 95% of the Rav's writings were written by his students, some of them during his lifetime, but a lot of it after his death. So for example, now on page 2, I bring over here to Al HaTshuva. Al HaTshuva is a collection of the Rav's essays. The Rav didn't write the essays. These were shiurim that the Rav gave about the concept of tshuva, about the concept of tshuva, the concept of repentance. So we're not going to get into tshuva right now. I want to show you something amazing that evolves from the post-1967 Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. How from the new Rav, who has to accept defeat, who has to accept limitations, look what the Rav writes. Look at paragraph A. Yeshno kav tragi mesuyam begoral ha'adam. There is a certain tragic element in the essence of man's life. Ukimat she'ein lecha adam. Ukimat she'ein lecha adam. She'eino muchrach leda'avol meiv. Lachios betragika zu hatervua ba'atzmius ha'adam. And the Rav says, there's a certain element of human tragedy that is embedded in the very fabric of the human condition. It's so embedded that no matter who you are, what you are, everyone experiences it. What is the Rav referring to? Listen to this line. Ha'anoshim v'ha'advarim ha'krovim v'ha'uvim b'yoser. Those people and those things that we love and that are closest to us, einam zochim l'ha'arachon nechona, kozman sheheim kayomim u'mitzuyim. We don't fully appreciate them. We don't fully understand the value of them while what? While they are alive and while we have them. So the Rav says something absolutely amazing. The Rav says that if you want to understand something that is just part of the fabric of the human condition, it's not that it's just the pshat with some people like other people. If there is something that is part of who and what we are is, we never fully appreciate someone until they're no longer here. This is even if you were a good spouse, a good child, a good sibling, a good friend. At the end of the day, what the Rav is saying is, we fail to comprehend the true totality and the true meaning of the individual while we have them. He goes on. The Rav says, we only begin to truly evaluate and truly understand the full measure of their greatness when they are separated from us and they have become distant images. Otos misturin, mysteries. Merachok heim romzim lo ata ki kochavim b'shamayim. Now our loved ones, his wording here is so dramatic. Our loved ones almost hint to us or blink at us, wink at us from a distance like stars in the heavens. Humakir be'erkam. Now when my loved one is gone, now I really understand their true worth, so to speak, their true value, their true measure. Ach eino yachol laga'as bohem. But now that I understand their true measure, their true value, now what? I can no longer touch them. Now they're no longer here. Kama krovim ve'kama ahuvim heim hayu lanu. How much we loved and how close our loved ones were to us. Abba, ima, a father, a mother, Rebbe, a teacher, ra'aya, a wife, baal, a husband, v'chozman shahayu imanu. And while they were with us, lo yadanu maspik ketzel harichem. We didn't know how to fully appreciate them. We didn't know, we didn't really understand. Very often, right, we saw their faults, we saw some of the, but we didn't really understand the true depth of the profundity of who they were until now that they're at a distance, like stars in the sky looking back at us. Paragraph B. Any medaber al anoshim. Look what the Rav qualifies this. He says, I'm not talking about people shlo kaimu bechayim misas kibur avayim, karoi, o shlo nagu kavod b'rabam, v'avas b'shutfon lechayim. So the Rav says, I'm not talking about people who abuse their relationships. I'm not talking about people who didn't respect their parents or people who abused the spouse. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, says the Rav, el davka ba'anoshim, shekibdu esar embiyosar. I'm talking about the people who did respect their parents. Heritzu es rabam, they respected their Rebbe. And they act v'nogu b'mesiras klabi abal yisha. And they went out of their way for a beloved spouse. Gam halolu muchrochim la'avor es ha-sevel Hakaruch Beregesh Ashma. Look at these words. The Rav says, even those individuals who were a good spouse, were a good child, still have to deal with the burden of the feelings of guilt. Al shelo asu b'mida maspekes mashiyuchlu la'asos. That they did not do everything they could have done. Kol od ahuveyem hayu b'chayim. While my loved one was alive. Mi she'eno misyaser b'regesh ashma. So the Rav, now here the Rav says something very dramatic. Whoever does not feel these pangs of guilt after a loved one is gone, meaning if someone actually says, so according to the Rav's worldview of relationships, if someone actually says, I feel no guilt. I feel no guilt. I was perfect in the relationship. I did everything I was supposed to do. So it says, if you don't feel that guilt, simon she'eno yodea techusha amitis shel evel al hayokar va'ahov shaholoch liblishuv. Then a person doesn't truly appreciate the full measure of the person who is no longer and will never return. Paragraph C. Shiva shloshim shnas avelos. A person goes through Shiva shloshim year of avelos. Kol ela him prate hateknika shel avelos shezdiru chachamim apitava adam. These are the technical aspects of mourning that Chazal instituted according to the disposition of man. But the essence of mourning, einot rak bitzar al haholech, elagam bikeev shel ilu yacholti. So the Rav here says something amazing. People think the pain that one feels over loss is not just about loss going forward, but the Rav calls this ilu yacholti. Ilu yacholti means what? If only I could. If only I could. What does it mean? If only I could. Ilu yacholti, if only I could, hayisi mitakin ata, mashalona hakti kedaboi. If only I had the chance, I would make right those things in the relationship that were wrong. Kasher haya biyacholosi linog acheres mimena shena hakti. Oh, if I had another chance, I would do things differently. Aba ma'aseh, what can I do? Ve'eni yachol litakin yoser es hamu'uvas, what can I do? I can no longer go ahead and fix. I can no longer straighten those things that are bent. So the Rav here advances an incredible, incredible idea. The Rav says that by definition, with loss comes guilt. Mm-hmm. But the reason that guilt comes, the Rav says, lest you think that that guilt is the result of a dereliction in my responsibility to the relationship, the Rav says, that's not what I'm talking about. If a person was derelict in a relationship, that's a whole other type of guilt. I didn't take good care of my parents. I wasn't a good spouse. I wasn't a devoted friend. Okay, that's guilt because I wasn't there. The Rav says there's a level of guilt, even if you were excellent in your relationship, even if you were the best spouse, best child, best friend. What's the guilt? The guilt, says the Rav, is I didn't really know who you were. I didn't really fully grasp what you meant to me until now that you're gone. And says the Rav, that's not because of anything I did wrong. What is that a result of? What is that a result of? That's a result of the human condition. It's a result of the human condition. The Rav says this is just part of the fabric of who and what we are. You know, when we do a levaya, so very often before the actual levaya starts, so there's a minhag to do mechila. There's a minhag to ask forgiveness from the deceased. Right. And the halacha says you don't have to articulate anything. But the relatives go over to the Aron, go to the casket, and they ask Mechila. And you know what I always tell people is in every life relationship, there are always things you say that you wish you didn't say. Always things I did that I wish I didn't do. And it's true. If you tell me that that didn't happen in your life relationships, excuse me, you're lying. It's not true. In every single, even the most loving of relationships, there are always those things that we said, I wish, I don't know, I said it, I was angry, I was frustrated, I wish I didn't say it. And the truth is, sometimes those are the most acute moments of pain for the avel. When the mourner has to approach the casket and has to ask mechila, and the mourner realizes in that moment that I can ask mechila, and Chazal tells that the neshama grants mechila, but I can never really take it back. I can never, there's no do-overs. I can't start again. You're gone. And now, had I really realized what you meant to me at the time when I committed those things that I should not have done, I would have never have done them to begin with. The only reason I did it is because I didn't really fully appreciate you when I had you. And again, says the Rav, this is just part of the fabric of the human condition. Skip to the next page. Turn to page 3. The Rav writes here in paragraph E. I included much more on the sheet than what we're going to do tonight. The sheets are yours. You'll go in. You'll fill in the blanks afterwards. E. Haga'aguim lazeh shahalach ve'enenu kashim kisha'ol. The Rav writes, the feelings, paragraph E, ga'aguim, the feelings of longing for my loved one who has left me and will not return are as difficult and as painful as the grave itself. Hanefesh yotzeis miga'aguim ad she'efshar liskaber aleihem. Sometimes the soul is also overwhelmed by mourning, by this longing, that literally nothing can overcome it. Now you have to understand what this statement means. This is very dramatic for the Rav to say this, because if you remember again, what did we learn last week about the Rav? What drives man? What is supposed to control man? His intellect, right? Halacha is the manifestation. His intellect, right? The Brisker, the whole Soloveitchik dynasty is built on the power of the intellect. So understand what the Rav just said here? There are times that emotion is so strong that even intellect can't vanquish. And they have to understand, for the Soloveitchik, this is like kfira, right? This is like apikarsis. This is heresy, right? To say again that the emotions could overrun the intellect. But again, remember, that's why I introduced tonight's class with the pre-1967 Rav and the post-1967 right. Rav. The pre-1967 Rav would have never said this. The pre-1967 Rav would have said, you have pain? I understand that. Now we use our intellect to overcome our emotional pain. The post-1967 Rav, who is in so much pain, has to accept the fact that there are times when pain is so intense that intellect cannot even overcome it. Listen. The other part also, which is very unique about the Rav, is, and I think I mentioned this in last week's shiur also, the Rav shared personal experiences, which again is very interesting, because remember, this is coming from a man who came from a family where his father never told him he loved him. His father never kissed him. Right now, the Rav knew his father loved him. The Rav knew his father loved him very much. It just, there was no external display from his father. The mother was different. There was no external display of emotion. And here, this man who came from this very stoic type of intellectual aristocracy shares some of his most intimate, almost innermost feelings. Look at these next lines. He says, "Hinei lefnei Rosh Hashanah zeh," and these are such emotional lines. Before this last Rosh Hashanah, "Amad lefonai," you know what stood before me? "Bidimyoni avi ha-gaon zatzal." So the Rav writes, you know, just before this past Rosh Hashanah, I saw in my mind's eye an image of my father. And my father stood before me. Hu haya Rebbe umori hayachid, shahaya li b'chol yimei chayai. So the Rav writes, my father was my only Rebbe. He was my Rebbe for my entire life. Achshav shitachti chayai lefanav amarti lo. And the Rav said, I had a conversation with my father. Listen, the Rav is allowing us to come into his, I had a conversation with my father. And he said, Abba Mori, my father, my teacher, kama chidushim chidashtei be'avodas Yom Kippurim. So the Rav is talking to his father. Father, how many new novel ideas I've come up with about Yom Kippur? B'sugya shal mitzos lav lehanos nitnu be'hilcha shofar. So the Rav begins to tell this image of his father about all of the new innovative ideas he has in all of these areas of halacha. B'vada yesh b'nehem dvorim shehayisa merutza mehem v'nena b'hem. And he says, Father, I know that some of these ideas you would love. V'yesh shelo hayu motzim chin be'inecha. And Father, there were some ideas that you would not like. V'hayisa docha osam. And you would disprove them. Kacha dibarti elov b'dimyoni. So the Rav writes, this is how he spoke to my father in my mind, in this image. Im she'adati, ki mi pi avi lo eshma hapam tshuva ladavar. So the Rav says, I spoke to this image of my father, even though what? I knew the image would never speak back. I knew the image would never converse back. Hoy, kama hayisi nosin, lu yacholti lahachlif imo dvarim b'chidushei Torah. He said, what I wouldn't give for the opportunity to exchange Torah thoughts with my father, falu lechamesh dakos bilvat. If I could just have 5 minutes with my father, what I wouldn't give for 5 minutes. Aval yadati, but I know deep down, ki hademus ha'ahuva shahayse krova kol kach elai, ki ata karachoka. But the Rav says, I know that the image I saw in front of me, as close as it looked, it was so far away. V'haleiv mispotseitz mibga'aguim le'efsharos shal chamesh dakos shal sicha. And what the heart is filled with is longing for just 5 minutes of conversation with the beloved father. Shelo yadanu tamid laharich es melo arka, a father that I never fully appreciated, says the Rav, when he was alive. Again, the Rav's not saying he wasn't a good son. What the Rav is just saying is the nature of the human condition, that we don't appreciate the people we have in our lives while we have them. Kasha adayin haisa imanu. Paragraph G, and this is where the Rav becomes very emotional. He says, v'huadin bi'imi u'bi'ishti. And these words, I think, I don't know of more emotional words that the Rav wrote. He says, and the truth is, it's not just with my father. He says, I have the same experiences with my wife, with my mother and with my wife, who again, of course, by the time the Rav wrote this, had both passed away. Lifnei yomim achadim, just a few days ago, shuv yashavti v'kasavti es joshas hatshuva hashnosis. So the Rav said, just a couple of days ago, I sat down to write my Shabbos Shuvah Drasha. Tamid hayisi medaber aleha imishti. I would always sit down and discuss my Shabbos Shuvah Drasha with my wife. Right? Rebbetzin Tanya Soloveitchik, Dr. Tanya Soloveitchik, was a Tamidah Chachama in her own right. And the Rav used to very often discuss many of his shiurim with his wife. So I sat down to do my Shabbos Shuvah Drasha. He haysa ozeresli begibush Harayonos belitusham. He says often what would happen is I'd have an idea, and my wife would help me to formalize these ideas, to formulate these ideas. My wife would help me with the word choices to express these ideas. Gam hashana, this year too, says the Rav. Kasafti es hadrasha, I sat down to write my Shabbos Shuvah drasha. Kisha ani shalosa, and I say to my wife, ulai tuchli la'azerli. Maybe you can help me. Shema kedai laharchiv olitzantzin ra'ayon ze o acher. Should I expound on this idea? Should I limit this idea? Shema lahagish nekuda plonis. Do you think I should stress this particular point? In paragraph H. Sha'alti, I asked my wife. Aval kol ma'ane loba. But no answer came. Efshar shehaya had kol she'ilasim. So the Rav writes, it's possible. Maybe she had called as a whisper. Maybe she whispered back to me. Aval hu nivla imeshev haruach bi'ilanos. But her whisper got carried away with the wind rustling through the trees. Ve'ilai lo higia. And it never reached me. So here you see an exceptionally dramatic form. Rav Soloveitchik, post-1967 Rav Soloveitchik. A man now who faced with the ga'aguim, the longings. A man faced with Ilya Choldi, if only I could have 5 minutes. A man who has to reconcile himself with the fact that no matter how wonderful the life relationship is, we never fully appreciate, understand, or comprehend the greatness of the people we have in our life until, again, they're no longer here. The post-1967 Rav has to accept the limitations. No matter how much sheer will, no matter how much strength, intellectual strength, no matter how much you push yourself, at the end of the day, there are certain things you can't conquer. There are certain realities which you must resign yourself to. Now, I want to show you, I'm just trying to show you a thread in some of the Rav's thoughts. If you turn to the next page, page 4, so we're not going to do this entire piece here, but actually, before we get to, well, look at page 4. So this is from a book called Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Man of Halacha, Man of Faith. It was edited by Rabbi Menachem Ginak. Rabbi Ginak is one of the primary Talmidim of the Rav, and he's the head of the Kashrus for the OU. So Rabbi Ginak edited a book about the Rav, and what he did in this book, and it's really fascinating, is he asked a number of students of Rav Soloveitchik to write about and to highlight a different aspect of their Rebbe. So there's an article over here, and the title of the article here, you see it on page 4. The article is called The Rav as Maspid. Maspid means what?
Eulogizer.
The Rav as a eulogizer. So what does this mean? So look, this is written by a rabbi, Dr. Marvin Fox. So Dr. Fox writes the following. He says, among the variety of forms which Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal shows for his writings, one of the most striking and instructive is the hesped, a eulogy given in memory of a recently departed figure of outstanding stature in the world of Jewish life, learning, or leadership. The corpus of his published works includes six such eulogistic essays, each one a carefully crafted study, which is a source of illumination and instruction. I shall try to show that an analysis of these eulogies opens up dimensions of the Rav's thought and method, which have not been sufficiently noted in the literature about his work. Each of them is of intrinsic interest and importance, making them eminently worthy of careful study. These hespedim should not be confused with the annual Yahrzeit Shiurim, which the Rav gave in memory of his father, or with lectures that he gave on similar memorial occasions. The eulogies which we shall study are of quite a different genre. In his essay, we do no more than make a first attempt to open up this fascinating area of Rav Soloveitchik's thought. So what Dr. Fox posits, there are six major eulogies that the Rav gave. Now you have to understand something. When the Rav gave a eulogy, as you're just going to see in just a little bit, it wasn't a eulogy, it was a shiur. But it was a shiur with incredibly deep, first of all, it was long. You'll see in just a little bit. But the amazing part about the Rav is the Rav was able to hold an audience. It didn't matter how long he spoke for. He was able to hold an audience. So what Dr. Fox wants to suggest is that the Rav used eulogies as another vehicle of study. One of the great things about the Rav is part of the Rav's philosophy of life is everything in life is a teachable moment, right? There are always opportunities for spiritual growth and intellectual maturation. Times of simcha and times of difficulty, there's always the ability to somehow pull out some kind of life lesson from whatever circumstance. So I want to show you one of these eulogies, which probably out of all of the Rav's eulogies is considered to be one of the most important works of the Rav, in that the Rav also espouses a number of important philosophical ideas. And it is the eulogy, which you turn to page 5, a tribute to the Rebbetzin of Talna. So again, first of all, you can see this is 10 pages. This was published in Tradition. Tradition is a journal of rabbinic works, of Torah works. So this was published in Tradition in 1978. Now, if you look on the bottom of the first page, which is page 5, you'll notice the small print. This article is a text of a eulogy delivered at the conclusion of the Shloshim for the Talmud Rebbetzin, Rebecca Twersky at Congregation Beth David, Brookline, Mass. Okay, so now the Talmud Rebbetzin, so who is the Talmud Rebbetzin? Of course, who was she? She was the wife of the Talmud Rebbe. Okay. Okay, that's the way it works. So the Talmud Rebbe was a Hasidic Rebbe, Rebbe Twersky, and the Talmud Rebbe and Rebbetzin were the Machatonim of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik's daughter married their son. So first of all, they were both in Boston. There is still to this day a Talmud-based medrash in Boston. I don't know how active it is, but there is a Talmud-based medrash in Boston. And so you had essentially the two major Torah luminaries, not just in Boston, but pretty much in New England. There wasn't really much else in New England, was the Rav and the Talmud Rebbe. And the Talmud Rebbe. So the Rav gives a major, major eulogy for the Talmud Rebbe when he passes away. And in 1977, he gives a eulogy at the end of the Shoshan for the Talmud Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin Twersky. So look what he writes over here. We're not going to do all of this. I just want to show you a couple of interesting things. So maybe we'll do some of this outside. Take a look at A. We'll just begin to read a few lines. He says, a hesped, funeral oration, an ancient biblical institution, pursues a twofold objective. It seeks, first of all, to make people weep. Agra dehespeda dalyue. In the merit of funeral oration is in raising a voice. The halacha, so the Rav goes on to explain that part of what we're supposed to accomplish in a eulogy is you're supposed to make people feel a loss. That's why, you know, it's interesting. This is a much broader discussion. There is an incredible discomfort with death in our present day and age. People don't like, I mean, obviously nobody likes death. But there's a discomfort with talking about death. That's why sometimes, and that has a lot to do with the fact that we live in a little bit of a hedonistic society. We're very much pleasure-oriented, maybe a lot, right? But we're very pleasure-oriented. So the notion of death makes us very uncomfortable, which is why many times when you go ahead and you go to a levaya, you know, it's interesting that, you know, sometimes the person will say, well, you know, today we want to celebrate his life. No, that's not what today is about. Today is not about celebrating his life. You'll have time to celebrate his life later on. Today is about mourning what has been lost. The goal of a hesped is that people in the audience should feel pain, because now after I hear about the greatness of an individual, I say to myself, my gosh, the world is lacking so much now that this person is no longer here. That's the job of a masvid. The job of a masvid, the job of a eulogizer, is not to make people feel good. It's not to go ahead and flip it around and turn it into something nice. And as a person, has to be very careful what they say in the eulogy, because the whole goal is to amplify the feelings of loss for everyone who is gathered. That's number one. However, skip down to paragraph D. The second objective, and again, this article, I would strongly encourage you to read this entire piece, because it is a work of spiritual art. But I'm just going to highlight a couple of things to you. So paragraph D. The second objective is a different one. At this level, so what's the second objective of the hesped? At this level, the hesped, turn the page to paragraph B, the hesped turns into kilos, eulogy, informative and instructional. Instead of addressing ourselves as we do at the first level to the heart, we try now to contact the mind. We no longer arouse emotions. We seek to stimulate thoughts by telling a story. What kind of story? Of course, there is only one story to be told, the life story of the deceased. This time, the oration becomes a portrayal of the person whom we bid farewell forever. The Rav goes on. Of course, this paragraph F, this description of the function of the hesped is quite paradoxical. The person lived many years in a town, made friends, was active in public affairs, meeting people, talking to them, living, praying, and doing things together. Disaster struck, and the person died suddenly. Acquaintances and friends assembled to mourn, to pay the last tribute to the person whom they knew very well. So why is it necessary to start de novo and reintroduce a person to old friends? Right? So the Rav is going to say, you're asking, why do I have to help? So look at numbers, paragraph G. Yes, it is strange. However, strangeness does not alter a tragic, perhaps tragic comical reality. Listen to these words. That man or woman, until his or her last day on earth, remains a sealed book, even to his or her closest friends, who supposedly knew him or her well. Anonymity is an integral part of the human existential destiny. Sof davar hakol nishma. The end of the matter, all is heard. Only at the conclusion of the davar, the human career, only at the end of the life story of the man or woman do people become inquisitive. Only then do they begin to inquire about him or her. Who was he or she? Only then hakol nishma. All kinds of questions are asked. Paragraph H. A while ago, people simply did not care. Now they are concerned. Now they do care. Yesterday, the question could have easily been answered. It could have been addressed directly to him or her. Today, we know not of whom to acquire. We know not who is in a position to answer this question. Nevertheless, Taloch insisted that the question be raised. See, hear what the Rav is saying? Now you understand why I did that piece from Ala Tshuva. Remember, this is post-1967 Rav. Ala Tshuva, what did Ala Tshuva Rav tell us? The Rav and Ala Tshuva said to us that in reality, we don't really know the people in our lives. We think we know them. We think we understand them. We think we're connected to them. But the Rav says something so, you understand what the Rav is saying over here, that a man or woman until his last day, I'm going back to paragraph G for just a moment, a man or woman until his last day on this earth remains a sealed book, even to his or her closest friends who supposedly knew him or her well. What a dramatic statement. We're so complex. You know, just lahavdil elef alfei rivei havdalos. But you know, it's coming out in the news now with this guy who perpetrated, the surviving brother who carried out, you know, the Boston Marathon attacks. And what people are not on this, what people are not understanding is nobody had any inkling about this. Right? Literally, he came across as just a regular college kid. No one even had this. You know, sometimes when Nebuch, these things happen, people see the markers. Yeah. People see, how could it be? How could it be? How could a person be such a closed book and reveal a sign that no one ever had any idea about. So the Hamdul Aleph Alpi Rebbe Abdul Rav says it's not just true with somebody who's sick, it's true with all people. We're all closed books. And the truth is, taking a step further, very often we're closed books to ourselves as well. But that's a different shir. That's a different shir. But the idea that Rav says is, what's the idea of a eulogy? The idea of a eulogy is to open the book. The idea of the eulogy is to tell everybody assembled, you think you know the person who passed away, but the truth is you didn't. Because what you knew was just simply the tip of the iceberg. What is the common denominator of virtually every single Shiva experience? What happens to Avelim during every single Shiva experience? I didn't know that. Isn't that interesting? See here, I've spent potentially, I've been married to this person for decades. This is the sibling I grew up with. It's fascinating that here there's someone who you felt so connected with, and then someone, a total stranger, knows something about your loved one that you didn't even know. Fascinating, says the Rav. That's the fabric of the human condition. It's the complexity of people. We're so multifaceted. We're so multidimensional. So our loved ones even only see one part of us. So the first part of the Hesbeth, says the Rav, is to be what we call ma'orer bechi, to awaken crying, to sensitize people to the loss. The second part is to unseal the book. We don't really know the people in our lives when they are in our life. The goal of a hesped is to allow everyone assembled to truly understand who and what this person was. So the Rav then goes on to explain in paragraph I. He says, with your permission, I wish to ask the strange question which a masped, funeral orator, must address to the grieving congregation. Who was the Rebbetzin of Talna? This noble woman who was snatched away from us so quickly. It is, as I said before, a paradoxical question. So the Rav, if you skip down a little bit, so the Rav writes, he says, in the course of the past 30 days, the social period of mourning, the truth began to dawn on us that actually we did not know her at all. That the woman we met and greeted every morning, Gudmargen Rebbetzin, was a cryptic figure, a kind of mystery. It is self-evident that now we are curious to find out who she was. Now we ask ourselves, who was the woman who never omitted tefillah b'tzibur, who could never catch up with the congregation, and who continued to recite her prayers long after the worshippers had left the synagogue? And the Rav goes on in paragraph K. And again, we're not going to make this about the Rebbetzin of Talna, but I just want to show you what the Rav was able to discover. So if you skip down paragraph K, so the Rav writes the following. The Rav writes, not many women today are quality. So the Rav writes, the Rav actually describes Rebbetzin of Talna in one word. He says, she was unusual. So the Rav says, I know you're going to think that's a strange word, but he says she was unusual because she belonged to a very unique community. The community that the Rav then goes on to explain, which we're not going to get into tonight, was the community of the Masorah. What the Rav essentially goes on to explain, or his perception, is that the Rebbetzin of Talna was unique, ultimately, not just for who she was as an individual, but because she was committed to being a chain in the link of the Masorah from all of those who came before her, and connect all of those who came before her to all of those ultimately would come after her. We could skip a little bit. I just want to show you something very beautiful. Skip a little bit to page 12. Page 12 in your handout, which is paragraph U. So just one description the Rav says over here. And again, you'll read the rest of this on your own because it's very beautiful. The Rav writes, let me tell you a story about the heroic performance of that woman which I witnessed. So that this is, again, here's a perfect example now of a story that the Rav's going to share. He's going to tell everybody about something that occurred and no one else has ever known about it until the Rav shares this. Let me tell you a story about the heroic performance of the woman which I witnessed. The Rebbe was critically ill. He had spent the first 2 days of Passover in the hospital. The Rebbetzin insisted that she stay with him. She rejected all offers from people who were ready to substitute. Erev Pesach, late in the afternoon, she came to the hospital dressed up in honor of the holiday and instructed me, Rav Soloveitchik, and her son to leave. Of course, she prepared everything at home. She also brought to the hospital the ritual articles for the Seder and began to set the table. A stranger could not have suspected that the husband of this woman who was setting a festive table was dying. I had tears in my eyes. She did not. She said to us, Gutyantiv, go home, for the hour is late. Turn the page. Quite often watching her, I used to wonder what kind of person this woman was. I could find no other answer but that she was a great woman in the heroic biblical tradition. So the Rav goes on again. If you take a look, paragraph W. So the Rav writes, quite often when I extended Good Shabbos greetings to her, I used to think of the great women through the ages who represented with wisdom, greatness, and dignity the Toras Imecha. Consciously or unconsciously, I greeted not only her, but her mother and mother's mother, the entire community of mothers who kept our tradition alive. I felt as if all of them had been assembled in the dining room of the Rebbetzin, as if Shabbos HaMalka herself had been present there. The room looked the way I imagined Sora's tent must have looked. It was enveloped in a cloud, and there was the burning candle. There was the Shekhinah. So again, why am I sharing all of this with you? Because I think what we see is something very dramatic. First of all, to bring everything together, number one is that the Rav was brave enough to reorganize his we'll call it intellectual framework, his life categorizations, that sometimes when we believe certain things to be true, and then those truths are challenged, very often we are resistant to reforging our personalities for a variety of reasons. We've lived a certain way for a long time. We have a lot invested in this particular lifestyle. And so even when we see that perhaps what we thought to be true is no longer true, we persist in perpetuating that earlier truth because to have to change and start again is too difficult. So first of all, you see the incredible bravery, but it's more than bravery. It's intellectual honesty of the Rav. So the pre-1967 Rav would have said, intellect conquers all. And if you can't conquer it with your intellect, then what does that say about you? You're lazy. Yeah. You're lazy. You're not trying hard enough. That's why the Talmidim got the brunt of the Rav's anger when they did not measure up to his expectations. Then what happens? The Rav realizes that there are certain realities in life that sheer will cannot conquer, that sheer will simply cannot traverse. There are things in life that happen. So what do you do when those things in life happen? To a certain degree, you have to accept them. And you have to learn to remake yourself in light of these brand new realities. The Rav learns this through the successive string of losses of his mother, his wife, and his brother. So post-1967 Rav, which was the Rav we saw in Alachuba, that Rav is filled with incredible, almost unbearable pain, longing for another 5 minutes with a beloved father, to be able to share a Torah thought with the beloved wife. And he knows intellectually that no matter how much he wants it, he won't what? He'll never get it. But he still can't stop himself from feeling it. He still can't stop himself from wanting it, even though intellectually he knows that he can't have it. And the Rav says, this is part to what ends up happening is these losses that the Rav endured in 1967 also changed the way the Rav views people. So it's not just that, yes, number one, intellect can't conquer everything. There are certain things sheer will can't accomplish. But more than that, it gives the Rav insight into people. Because now what does he realize? The father I thought I knew, I didn't fully appreciate him. Not that I loved him, I was a good son. I didn't fully comprehend what he was all about. The wife who I loved so much was my partner. I didn't fully appreciate her for what she was when she was alive. Not because I didn't love her, but because I didn't know. Because there are certain things in what? There are certain things that you can't know until it's gone. You can't know until that loved one is not. It's the great catch-22. It's the great anomaly of the human condition. That I want to love my loved one. I want to know my loved one. But there will always be parts of them, as the Rav says in the Hesped, that are a sealed book. That we'll just never know. So it changes the Rav's outlook in terms of life. 1967 changes the Rav's outlook on people. To the point when he's maspid, when ultimately he eulogizes the Rebbetzin of Talna, he says to them, Marana Barabanan, I have to tell you, we're here for two things. We're here, number one, to cry, to appreciate the loss, and more importantly, we're here to ask ourselves a fundamental question. Who is the Rebbetzin of Talna? Because although you think you know, there are so many aspects of this woman, and the Rav says, I'm going to share with you things that I saw that I know none of you saw. By definition, that helps to highlight this idea of each of us being a sealed book. So this really gives us an insight into the Rav, which I think we could truly identify with also. Because number one, we all go through those periods of life where we assume we could conquer everything through sheer will and perseverance. And usually life deals us a pretty stark blow where it reminds us that there are certain things we can overcome and certain things with which we must contend and resign ourselves to. But the greatness of we see about, same thing with people. There are things we know about people, but we have to accept that A, we don't know everything, people are a sealed book, and B, none of us fully appreciate the loved ones we have, and therefore each of us will have to experience the existential pain that comes along with loss of only realizing what we truly had only now once it's gone. But the same way, I think what I take from this personally is that the same way that the Rav had the courage post-1967 to remake his personality, to be able to face the new realities of his existence so we can grow from that as well. And we can learn this same level of strength that often in life, we have to remake ourselves. And often in life, we're resistant to do that because we have so much vested in our previous personalities that we don't want to give it up, even though we know that it's wrong. But in addition to learning all the Torah from the Rav, we can learn from the man who was the Rav. And just like when he realized that what he thought was not necessarily true, he remade and reforged his personality, we should find the courage to do the same. All right, we'll stop over here.
Rabbi, I just think this idea of change comes back over and over in the 100%. Rabbi, because I remember when he was teaching, he said, this, the Chazal came, and then came 100%. This one, and there was a symphony of whatever, all the, you know.
It's 100% true.
I mean, he always saw it, everything as related, which is very hard to see.